in a couple of weeks, the week after Thanksgiving. That Wednesday, we may or may not have class. I may have to go to Washington, D.C. to defend a proposal. So just be aware. I'll send out emails so that everybody knows well ahead of time. But for now, at least today, let's concentrate on finishing up fluid mechanics and doing whatever exam review y'all want me to do. I think I have about a little over an hour of fluid mechanics to cover, because there are quite a few extra things to cover before we get there. And then after that, and before the final, we'll get into simple harmonic motion, periodic motion. And that'll be it, and you'll be done with me. Yay! So. Third midterm is on Monday. Remember that homework notebooks are due at the end of that exam. So when you turn in your exam, we'll also have a stack over there for you to put your notebook on. We don't want to take it away from you before the exam, because you might use it during the exam, of course. So we'll have a reminder to turn it in at the end of the exam. And if you have any questions about it, I'll cover it in a sec. Happy birthday to some people, and happy holiday, whatever it is. So that today is Party With Your Bear Day. So Leonard DiCaprio's favorite holiday. Midterm three, we covered this. I sent out a sample exam of some types of questions. That exam that I sent out is probably a little long and a little hard compared to the exam that you guys will get. So, but it's a good stretch goal for you to work through some of those problems. And if you ask me some of those problems during review today, I will work through them on the board for you. That includes stress, strain, shear. It includes fluid mechanics. But the biggest section, of course, is all about rotational motion. And I'll, like I said, I'll have a handout cheat sheet attached to the exam copies that we give out, so you can look up numbers on them. You shouldn't have to spend time during the exam looking up numbers. The homework notebooks will be graded on a 3 or 4 point scale, right? Is it great? Is it okay? Is it or did you not turn it in at all, kind of thing? But it ends up counting about 5% of your total grade, right? About 1/6 of your total homework grade is the quality and appeal of that notebook. That also means turn it in. 5% is gone if you don't. On the other hand, don't freak out about is it completely legible and completely well organized. Turn in what you have. Are there any questions about the homework notebook? I know I've address some with individuals leading up to this point. Yeah?
We did some of the homework in the notebook. We don't have to do that now.
Well, I mean, there are two alternatives. You can make copies and turn in the copies if you want to keep the notebook with you. Or you can turn it in at the end of the midterm, not have to worry about physics while you're eating turkey and watching football, and we'll give it back to you on Monday. Right. Make sure that your name is on your notebook, however. I've had people turn in notebooks, and it's like, oh, you know, I have no idea whose notebook this is. I figure it out from handwriting. So that's a little bit of a drag. But yes, absolutely. I mean, we will do everything we can to get it on Monday and give it back to you the following Monday. So, example, you know, this is one of the example cheat sheets. I showed this in the last class. And there will be another sheet or two with all kinds of constants from strain, shear, and stress. Yes. So a quick review from last class. We'll go back over moduli and strain, stress, and shear again. I did this in last class where I emphasized that really the stuff that Dr. Balsha had gone over a little while back is all about stress is a pressure, force per unit area, whether it's pulling, whether it's pushing in one dimensional, whether it's three dimensional and compressing something or trying to expand something, whether it's shearing something and trying to cut it, It's the same thing, it's the same units, it's force per unit area. Force per unit area is also a pressure, units are pascals. The changes that these things create are all, in the elastic limit at least, proportional changes. Delta L over L for linear stuff, delta V over V for volumetric stuff, and angles for shear. We don't go that much into shear in this class. It's a little more complicated. But those moduli, those ratios of those things, are fundamentally material properties. So you have a table, you can look up the Young's modulus of stainless steel. You can look up the Young's modulus of oak wood, or whatever material you've got that you have to do your engineering designs about. This relationship between stress and strain is a linear one, and the law, the name of that law, is called Hooke's law. Remember with the spring, we had the force is proportional to the deformation of the spring, F equals minus kx. That's the force that the spring exerted on us. So the force that we're putting on the spring is the opposite of that, Newton's third law, right? So, and that's exactly what's plotted here, is a line that says force is proportional to the distance that something is stretched, or vice versa. So F equals kx, the slope of that line is this spring constant, and because this is linear, this is Hooke's law. And then if you go beyond that, beyond the elastic limit of stretching or compressing something, this is using Young's modulus, this is a one-dimensional example, then you start really having to use extra force to deform the object, and then it finally falls apart. So, and by that point, when you go past that elastic limit, the material is damaged. The material has changed somehow. You've really overstretched or overcompressed your spring, and it's not going to come back to where it started if you let go. We talked a little bit last class about construction, engineering construction, materials under both stress and strain, like beams, and a header or a cross beam or something that is under its own weight is going to be under both compression and tension. And for a lot of materials, they work better under compression than under tension, right? Trees are evolved to withstand a great deal of compression because they have to support their own weight. Concrete is fantastic under compression, less so under tension. You don't take a concrete beam and pull on it on both sides and expect it to stay integral, unless it's got rebar in it. But this is all, you know, applications of these concepts of strain, stress, shear, that type of thing. So, and then we started talking about fluid mechanics, and we'll go into more material on fluid mechanics, and I'll go through a couple of examples in the notes that we didn't go into last time. So this has a little bit of extra stuff in it that connects fluid mechanics back to the ideas of strain and stress, right? And that is this concept of what is the difference between a fluid and a solid, or a non-fluid. And at least for these purposes here, fluids are materials that cannot sustain shear. So if I take a material and I push it, try and shear it against itself, right, it will just slip. It will not push back on me at all. It has zero shear modulus. It just slips. Okay? And that's kind of not an obvious, but actually kind of a satisfying definition of what a fluid is. Because it also means that something like glass, and I know many people have heard that ooh, glass flows really slowly, and you look at old windows and they're thicker at the bottom than the top because they've sagged under the force of gravity over 100 years and all sorts of stuff like that. There's actually contention about that idea, about whether glass is a liquid or an amorphous solid. But according to this definition, at least, I can take glass and I can apply a shear force, and by gosh, it's going to fight me until it breaks. So glass, in this definition, is certainly not a fluid. Something very much, a much, much thicker, more viscous fluid, like pitch. Pitch is like a very, very dense tar. There is a famous webcam, a pitch. There's an experiment where they put a bunch of pitch in a funnel and watch it drip out. And they have a webcam on this, and they watch it literally for decades. Over something like 100 years of this experiment, I think there have been 2 or 3 drops. Talk about patience. The pitch, look up the pitch experiment, the flowing pitch experiment. So that is kind of, you know, barely a liquid, but for most part, a fluid. For the most part, we're going to consider easy things. We're going to consider water, mercury, stuff that clearly flows and flows under reasonable pressures. Now, we're also going to consider stuff that flows, for here at least, stuff that under reasonable pressure does not change its volume. So we are not considering gases. If I take gas and compress it, PV equals nRT, I can certainly reduce its volume. So we're considering fluids that are incompressible liquids. And by incompressible, it means when I put pressure on it, it doesn't change its volume. If you go back and look at the definition of what bulk modulus is, there's pressure divided by change in volume. For any pressure, this change in volume is zero, the bulk modulus is basically infinite. So in the technical terms that we just had, what we are going to talk about for the rest of fluid mechanics in this course is fluids, things that have zero shear modulus, that are incompressible, so they have infinite bulk modulus. That's it. And this is a reasonable approximation for water and stuff like that. And then the distinction between gases and liquids traditionally has been, if I don't put pressure on it, okay, does it maintain a well-defined surface or not? Is there a layer that is clearly well-defined that separates this material out from atmosphere? If there is, it's a liquid. If there's not, it's a gas. That's kind of another practical definition of the two. So we have density. You know what density is? Mass divided by volume. We're assuming that, okay, since these are incompressible fluids have constant density throughout. I can't pack more mass into a given volume. I can't remove more mass from that volume and expand them. They have infinite bulk modulus. So constant density is perfect for our fluids that are incompressible. So far, so good. So, and everything has a pressure, right? I put something in a glass, and it pushes the bottom of the glass down a little bit. I put it in a paper cup, and the bottom of the paper cup bulges out. Certainly, there has to be some force supporting that liquid, and there has to be some force from that fluid exerted on not just the bottom of the container, but the sides of the container. If I poke a hole in the side of my paper cup, that fluid is going to jet out. Therefore, there is a force pushing on that fluid over that little cross-sectional area. There is a pressure. And I could even, my gosh, construct a problem where I measure the pressure at the bottom of that cup by poking a hole in and seeing how far the water jets out. And then do a bunch of math. So So this is review from last class. We went through the cup example, an example of a fluid in a tank, and figured out, okay, at the bottom of this tank, what is the pressure exerted by the weight of this column of fluid on top of it, and by the pressure of the atmosphere even on top of that as well. So this P0 is the pressure of the atmosphere on top of the fluid of a certain cross-sectional area A. I look at a column of height H and look at that same cross-section at the bottom, and that cross-section has to support both this pressure and the weight of this column. So the force at the bottom is that force from the top, that pressure times that area. Pressure is force per unit area, right? Plus the weight of the column. And then what I can do is I can then figure out what the pressure is at the bottom, because that's the total force divided by area. All the A's cancel out, and I get this magic formula, which lets you calculate the pressure at any given depth or height, any given depth within a fluid. And that P0 is the atmospheric pressure, the pressure at the top of the fluid. So here's a simple example, but it's a practical one, and it's one I thought of when I took a shower this morning. Right? So usual water pressure is 60 pounds per square inch in a house. Domestic water pressure, it varies between 60 and 80. That's the regulation, at least. And so, okay, that's my pressure on the first floor. What's my pressure in a second floor faucet? Certainly everybody here who has been in a two-story house knows that the water pressure is lower on the second story than the first story. So I can figure that out. P equals P0 plus rho gh, the density of the water. So the difference in the two pressures is the density of the water times g times how far up I've gone in that water column, which is 14 feet. The density of pure water, it'll be on the sheet, but it's easy to remember. It's 10 to the third kilograms per cubic meter. A gram per cubic centimeter. I think it's almost defined that way, actually. And then it's 14 feet up. You can convert that feet to meters if you want. Or you can, like me, just type this into Google. And I type it into Google and I say, give me the answer in PSI, and it's 6 PSI, which is a certain number of pascals. So that's 6 PSI out of 60. You lose 10% of your water pressure per floor. Three floors, 20%. You know, two floors, up 20%. So if you build the skyscraper, you better have extra pumps, and you better have water storage systems at various places in your building, because you're not just pumping, under normal pressures at least, all that water way, way up. This also begs a question. This is just 14 feet up, and there is a 10% drop in pressure. Right? 140 feet up means that there's a 100% drop in this type of pressure. Trees grow that tall. Trees get water up there. Trees don't have active pumps. And trees take advantage of a completely different property of water, which is its viscosity and surface tension, and something called capillary action, where water can more easily crawl up very, very small vessels. And so instead of simple hydrodynamics like this, the way that trees work is actually more complicated and depends specifically on the exact properties of water at a microscopic scale. It's another one of those little miracles of the world and of science, but it's physics, but it's another miracle of the physics of water. So we reviewed Pascal's law last time, right? If I've got an incompressible fluid, if I define this force per unit area as pressure, And this pressure is evenly distributed among all sides of a vessel. Right? Here, for example, this pressure is not just the pressure applied to the bottom of this vessel here, of this column. But I said nothing about the sides. It turns out that there's also the same pressure against the sides of this cylinder, of this column, as there is on the bottom. A little section of water in here has no idea, you know, which direction is preferred over any other as long as its height is very, very shallow. So for a vessel, this pressure, if this pressure is even on all sides, then that means if I create a vessel that has two sides that move, like pistons, and the pressure is the same on both of them, well, pressure is force per unit area. So I can have one with a small area and one with a big area, and I can relate the two. And those two pressures have to be equal for an incompressible fluid. So that means the force per unit area here has to be equal as well. So if this area 2 is very, very large, then the force 2 is force 1 times the ratio of A2 over A1. This force 2 can be much, much larger than this force 1. I can use this as a lever, as a multiplier. In fact, this is exactly the principle behind hydraulics, not pneumatics, but hydraulics, is the multiplication of force by moving an incompressible fluid around. So the other thing you can figure out is force times distance, and force times distance here. If I push this down a meter, and this area is 5 times larger, it's only going to move up 20 centimeters, right? The same volume of fluid gets pushed around from place to place. If I move this volume down, the same volume goes up over here. Bigger cross-sectional area, so smaller height. So that force times distance, I get that magnification of a factor of 5 over here for 5 times the area. But I move it over 1/5 the distance, and the total work I do is the same. So I don't get energy for free. I don't get work for free this way. But I do at least get to move something much, much heavier than I expected to with Pascal's law, with this type of system. So this is close to where we ended last class, right? Which is talking about pressure in a fluid over different materials, right? And pressures. There's an old adage, water always seeks its own level, right? An incompressible fluid, if you pour it into a container, the surface of that fluid will be a level. And for any depth down that fluid, wherever you go, in whatever section, whatever kind of contortion you have in this device, the pressure at this location in this curvy tube is the same as this pressure at this location in this straight tube. Even though it sure looks like there's a lot more water, there's a lot more blue fluid above this guy, and the pressure here should be greater than here, because gosh, this tube seems to be supporting some of this liquid, and this tube is not supporting this liquid, and there's more liquid above me. Naively, you'd guess that the pressure here and the pressure here are different. Nope. Okay? It's a statics problem, and what you need to do is look at every little tiny piece of that fluid individually and realize that, okay, this guy may look like he's got more stuff above him, but by gosh, he's also got more area, cross-sectional area, to support that fluid. If I were to pinch this down, like over here, does this guy have higher pressure because he's got more fluid above him, but he's got the same cross-sectional area? Nope, because part of this glass is also providing some of that upward force and part of that pressure as well. Everything at the same height has the same pressure. That's it. Any little local area here, any local piece of this fluid, doesn't know, am I in a curved tube or a straight tube? So I can look at his pressure, and all his pressure knows is I'm this deep in the fluid. And all the forces balance on every small section of that fluid. Now this is, there's something, you know, deep that comes out of this. That's Archimedes' principle. If I take some little piece of this and realize that, hey, that little block of this fluid here is not moving. So it must be in static equilibrium. All his forces must cancel out. Now he's got mass, so he's being pulled down, so the average forces on him from the surrounding liquid must keep him up somehow. That's Archimedes' principle. We'll get into that next and then do a problem. So I've got some little section, and I can make this as big or as small or as weird as I want. But I take some section of that fluid and I do a thought experiment. I say, is that fluid moving? Nope. Right? The fluid is not spontaneously mixing by itself. It's all just sitting there in equilibrium. And no sections are moving around. So I can draw a box in there. I can say, hey, you little section, you're not moving. You're in equilibrium. The average of all the forces on you has got to be counteracting another force that I know is also acting on you, which is gravity. And that force, that counteracting force, is called buoyancy. And we can figure out what buoyancy is. Certainly here, the buoyancy, that force up, has got to be exactly the weight of the fluid pushing down, because the fluid isn't moving in equilibrium. Now you can make the great leap. And it is a great leap. A great abstraction of saying, wait a second. It doesn't have to be that the forces being exerted on that volume don't know that that's a fluid. It could be something else, an object that I've submerged that's exactly the same shape and size. And the forces on that object that I've submerged have got to be the same as the fluid that wasn't moving. If I take that object out and that volume is just the fluid instead. So I submerge an object, and okay, the force of gravity is different because, by gosh, it's an object. It's a rock or a piece of lead, whatever it is. But the forces exerted by the fluid that cause the buoyancy are the same. So the buoyancy, the force of buoyancy, is the force that it would be required to support that volume of fluid against gravity. And from there, you can calculate the buoyant force of anything, and we'll do that in a second. So a body immersed in water or in a fluid, right? Immersed in mercury is great because mercury is really dense. And so, gosh, there are a lot of forces exerted on that mercury to support it against gravity. When a body is less dense than the fluid, it just floats, and only a portion of the object submerges that displaces enough fluid to balance out through buoyancy that object's weight. For those of you that are swimmers or divers know you got to wear a weight belt, because when you go into water, okay, you're pretty close. You're mostly water bags. Your bodies are mostly water. But there's also some stuff in there that's a little bit less dense than water, and bodies tend to float up. You've got lungs filled with air, for example. Helium balloons. Why does a helium balloon work? Because that volume is filled with a material that's less dense than air. And so it's not that the balloon moves up, but that the atmosphere wants to get underneath it, because the atmosphere around it is more dense, is heavier than the balloon. And that atmosphere is what pushes the balloon up. So these are all examples of Archimedes' principle. Archimedes' principle, another classic example, is the little kind of a thought experiment where you're riding in a car and you got a helium balloon because you're a kid and you just went to a candy store or whatever and you got a balloon, yay! And the balloon is hanging straight up. And then your parent sitting beside you hits the gas and accelerates out of the red light. Does the balloon move backward like your body, or does the balloon move forward? Okay. Or does it not move at all? Which way does the balloon go? So when you accelerate, the atmosphere in the car moves back more than the balloon does. It's just like a gravity gradient. It's just like gravitational acceleration. A balloon is pushed up by the push of the atmosphere underneath, by that difference in density. So as the car accelerates, magic happens and the balloon moves forward. Try it sometime, but not when you're the one driving. So here's a little example, and okay, I got tired of doodling around. You know, I just drew this on the board at work last night and took a photo and pasted it in. Sorry for the horrible art. So let's say that you're out in a freshwater lake and you tie something to a log, an anchor to a log, and you throw it over and it's all submerged. And the log, of course, you know, wants to float. It's less dense than water is. So the question is, what's the tension on the rope in this picture of this log with a particular diameter and a particular length and things like that tied to a heavy anchor and thrown overboard? The mass of that log is 12 kilograms. I give you the mass. And I give you all the dimensions of the log and that it's a cylinder. So you can figure out the log's density. Right? The mass divided by the total volume. And then you can realize that the log's density is less, substantially less than that of water. The log is going to want to float. So that's good. And now I can draw, oh God, here we go, a free body diagram. There's a buoyancy force, there's a force trying to float the log, the force of the water underneath, the extra pressure lifting the log. There's the force of gravity pulling down, and then there's also the tension of that rope attached to the anchor pulling down. Newton's second law, can't escape it. Draw the diagram, write it down. The net force, this is in equilibrium, so the net force is equal to zero. It's the buoyancy force up and the gravity and tension down. So the tension is this thing in here. What was the equation for buoyancy? How did you figure out the force of buoyancy? It's the weight of the water that would be in that volume. The mass of the water that would be in that volume is the density of the water times the volume of the log. That's how much water would be there if I took the log away. And, of course, the force is just, you know, the weight, the mass times g. So the force of buoyancy here is g times the volume of the log times the density of the water, the fluid that it's in. And then I can figure out mg of the log itself, and from there I can figure out the tension. So the volume of the log is this. Plug that in. The density of water is 10 to the 3rd kilograms per cubic meter. I know what g is. so I can figure out the buoyancy from that. It ended up being 154 newtons. Turned out 9.8 times 12 is about 118 newtons. That's mg in here. And so tension is the buoyancy force minus mg, and that's the net tension on the rope, 36 newtons. Simple enough. But the key concept in here is this application, that the buoyant force is the mass of that volume of the fluid times g, right? Because if I did this problem and I said instead of a log, that was a perfectly massless shell filled with the same fluid, it would float exactly there and the tension would be zero. Yeah. Volume of the log is the, take the radius is 10 centimeters, pi r squared is the circular area times the length. Now, if I give you the dimensions of a cylinder, you can figure out the volume. Are there any questions about this one so far? So, I sent out a sample exam last night, right? And this is one of the questions. This is the fluid mechanics Archimedes principle question in that sample exam, which is talking about a slab of ice now. And I give you the density of the ice, and I give you the density of the water on your little cheat sheet. So I put them here. And there's this big old slab of ice that's square sitting on some fresh water. And I'm asking you how much of it is above the water and how much of it is beneath. You're in the Titanic and there's the iceberg. How much of the, you know, how much of the ice is above the water line and how much of it is hiding beneath about to kill you? So here I figure out part A. I show you how to figure out part A. And this is even easier than the previous problem, right? I mean, the ice is floating. You know ice floats on water. It's got a lower density than the water does itself. So it's going to float. And there are only two forces acting on it. There's the buoyant force, and there's the force of gravity. There's the weight of the ice itself. And those two, since this thing is in equilibrium, those two forces have to add up to zero. So the buoyant force is the weight of the slab of ice. I got this thing is a certain volume, 2 meters times 2 meters, times 1 meter is the volume. And then multiplying it by the density of the ice, I get some nice kind of round number for the mass of that chunk of ice. What's the buoyant force? Remember, the buoyant force is how much volume I displace times the density of the fluid times g. So the density of the fluid, this thing is sitting in water, so I use the density of water. How much is in the water? That's the volume of the thing that's submerged, the piece of the ice that's submerged. I don't know that yet. Something we're going to have to figure out. And I do know g. So I figure out the volume that's submerged in here, at least. All of this has got to equal the weight of the ice. So I can figure out the total volume of the chunk of ice that's submerged has got to be 2.4 cubic meters. I know it's 2 meters on a side square, so I can figure out how much of the total height is underneath the water, and that's 6/10 of a meter. This question asks how much is exposed above the lake surface, how much does not submerge, and that's the other 4/10 of a meter, the other 40 centimeters. So the answer to part A is 40 centimeters is exposed above the ice, above the water. Part B is straightforward enough, right? If a 75 kilogram woman steps on this, there's an extra force acting down. this mg is not just the ice times g, it's the ice times plus the woman times g. So there's an extra bit of force in this mg here, and more of the ice is going to be submerged under the water, maybe even to the point where it goes underwater, or maybe not. I don't know. Work it out. The first time I wrote this problem, actually, it didn't work out that way. The ice clearly went underwater. I changed the numbers so that at least the ice stays above the water when the woman steps on it. And then when the woman now jumps on the ice, she's accelerating her mass. F equals ma. There's an additional force that you add in here that's not just her weight, but the additional force necessary to accelerate her. That force on her is acting up, so the force she's exerting on the ice is acting down, and there's extra weight going down, extra force going down. And now the question is, does the ice go under the water or not? From that set of forces, do they overcome the buoyancy or not? That's it. That's Archimedes' principle. Are there any questions about Archimedes? And yes, he was the owl, I think, in The Sword and the Stone, or the old Merlin myth. How did I find the height of the submerged? So I found I had to find the volume of the bit that was submerged from Archimedes' principle. And then I know the cross section is 2 meters per side square. And I know then the volume is that area times the height. So I could take that volume that was submerged and divide it by 2 meters square on a side to get the height that was submerged. Because it's a square parallel pipette. A square prism. So far, so good. There is a couple more things about fluids, because we want to get to fun stuff, which is airfoils at the very end, because you guys are engineers and that kind of thing is cool. So because these fluids are incompressible, right, we're talking about fluids that don't change their volume as they move around. That's exactly why Pascal's law works. The total volume of this fluid is always the same. Okay? That also means that as the fluid starts moving, if a bit of fluid moves over here and enters a pipe, the same volume of fluid better exits the pipe over there. I can't compress the fluid. Right? Just like I'm pushing on anything solid or anything that doesn't change volume, if I push on one side, the same amount is going to come out the other side, just like the toothpaste. Divide by time, and you get something called the continuity equation. The area now times the velocity of an incompressible fluid that's flowing is a constant throughout the flow. So everywhere that I'm flowing through a tube, the area times the velocity is constant. This is a mathematical way of saying that the fluid volume is conserved. What goes in has to come out. Okay? But it has some nice and useful and interesting implications that we get into. And the volume flow rate, I mean, how much of this stuff is coming out? This is, anybody that's done plumbing or done pumps knows this thing. Volume flow rate is total volume of this fluid per unit time. Gallons per second. You go into Lowe's or Home Depot and look at the faucets. They're rated in gallons per second. They're rated in flow rate. A pump that you go and buy for your pool or whatever is rated in terms of flow rate, gallons per second. So how much volume am I moving through this thing per unit time? Well, you can figure out that this thing here, this area
times the volume that's flowing is how much stuff moved in a given amount of time. And so this thing that's conserved is really the volume flow rate, is really the gallons per second or liters per second, whatever it is. So volume flow rate describes how now this fluid that we were previously treating as static is starting to move. As I move it through a pipe, if I push, if I have a slow velocity through a large cross section, and then I neck it down to some little pinhole, of course, the stuff that's coming out there is going to have a large velocity, as any kid playing with a garden hose can attest. So here's kind of a classic or a standard example, right? Household plumbing again. No, I haven't been working on my, okay, I've been working on my household plumbing. Your kitchen faucet produces a flow rate of 2 gallons per minute. That's kind of a standard number, actually, for typical faucets that you get out at Lowe's. And the faucet nozzle is a certain area. And I calculated that area. That's not the total area of the cross-section. If you actually look at your faucet, it's got something called a diffuser in it. It's a little kind of set of cross hatches, a little grid that actually makes the volume substantially smaller and also mixes in air into the water. If you take that thing out and turn on your water, it actually kind of almost just dribbles out, particularly if you're on the second or third floor. So it narrows down the area to make the water come out faster for you, too. So here's a rough area, at least. And now what I can do is I can say, okay, that 2 gallons a minute is the flow rate, 2 gallons per minute. And that's equal to the area times the velocity of the water coming out. So that means I can just move that area over. I can figure out the velocity of the water coming out. Type this into Google so I don't have to figure out gallons and minutes to seconds and gallons to meters or things like that. I end up getting 2 meters a second, 4 miles an hour. Doesn't feel very fast. Well, you don't want your water coming out of your tap at 60 miles an hour. It'll clean your silverware, among other things. Okay. It is still pretty fast. Now, another thing about pressure that's rather remarkable, pressure is force per unit area. So force per unit area, multiply the top and bottom by a distance, and what do you get? You get force times distance per unit volume. Force times distance is work, is energy. So pressure is another way of indicating energy per unit volume. And in fact, the energy per unit volume, right, what's the water pressure here? You can do that exact same thing. You can take that average velocity of those particles of the water coming out of that nozzle, and then you can divide it by volume. Mass per unit volume is the density. This is an incompressible liquid. I know the density of water. I don't have to know the mass or the volume. I have to know the mass divided by the volume to do this calculation. And so I can actually figure out through this what the water pressure is. And it's a couple thousand pascals above air pressure. Not that much. Turns out, 60 psi is kind of the standard household water pressure. There's a little bit of a lie in the simple calculation. If you go and look up the real pressure in your household system, it's much, much higher. But that diffuser also, by virtue of mixing in all that air, also makes this thing not not an energy conservation matter anymore. It takes a lot of the energy out of your water to mix it in with the air. But this concept, at least, that pressure is force per unit area, is also force times distance per unit volume, which is energy per unit volume. Pressure is an energy density, is kind of cool, and not at all intuitive. But we use that concept in even crazy stuff like nuclear physics. We talk about pressures of nuclei, which is just energy density again. So that flow rate thing, right? That continuity equation, that what goes out, what comes in has to go out, what goes in has to come out thing, explains lots of stuff that you can observe. So if you observe something like, for example, honey dripping, and you say, okay, that's all surface tension, not just surface tension, because this fluid, as it's dropping, of course, every little bit of that fluid is accelerating under the force of gravity, and it's dropping. So as it's accelerating, its velocity is higher and higher. So its cross-sectional area for the same amount of volume better go down. That's exactly why a fluid, when you drop it, necks down. And you can see that cross-sectional area decreases. You can figure out the math of this. The velocity is going up linearly, so the area better go down linearly. And if you take one of these pictures and actually look at it, yeah, okay, aside from this area up here, which is kind of complicated with surface tension things, the rest of this necks down pretty linearly. It looks pretty much like a straight cone. So it works. And that area reduces as the velocity increases until, of course, the honey hits the bowl and then other crazy things happen. So this may be simple enough. Okay. This is just conservation of mass divided by time. But this is just conservation of that fluid, that incompressible fluid. But now this is the good part. And that is not just applying conservation of volume, but conservation of energy or energy density, right, to our fluid. And this is Bernoulli. And this is why planes work. This is why all kinds of crazy things happen, right? So I take conservation of energy, and now I'm going to apply it to my fluid. Well, I could take some little piece of the mass and see how far I move it. That's work, force times distance. Okay. I could, you know, do mgh, the gravitational potential energy. Okay, I got that. I could do 1/2 mb squared. That's the kinetic energy. Okay, I got that. But all of those depend on the mass of the thing I'm moving. And now this is a fluid. What I really know about the fluid, what's really a material property, is the density, mass per unit volume. So take conservation of energy and divide everything by volume. And all of a sudden, I have something magic that happens. Energy, right? Force, work per unit volume. Oh, I just talked about that. That's pressure. Potential energy per unit volume. I can take the mass term and I can divide it by volume, and instead of mass, I get density, the material property of that fluid. And 1/2 mv squared, same thing. I can get density in there instead of the mass. And then this thing at point one equaling that thing at point two, all of that stuff is just conservation of energy. That's saying that all of this stuff set together is the same here as here. That's Bernoulli. And all it is conservation of energy divided by volume for incompressible flow. But it's talking now about how incompressible fluids move. It's talking about incompressible fluid dynamics. The other thing is that Bernoulli and the continuity equation are not the same thing, right? Continuity, that this continuity equation here is saying that the density of my material doesn't change as I move around, right? That the material is conserved. What goes in must come out. That's like conservation of mass. What Bernoulli is conservation of energy. And so now we can take a look at some examples. And many of the examples don't worry about the gravitational potential energy. Let's cross that out and say the height is the same on both sides. If y1 and y2 are the same, both of these drop out. But now what it does is it magically says something about pressure and the velocity of the fluid. Because remember, the density ain't changing. This thing is incompressible. So it relates the pressure and volume of a fluid as it moves. And a great example of this, and it's not completely obvious, is a Venturi meter. How do you measure the flow of a fluid through a pipe? Okay, you could put in some little valve with a propeller, but you're taking energy away from your fluid as it flows, and you're taking a lot of energy away, and you're creating all kinds of turbulence and crap like that that you might not want. And it's a moving part to your system. That little turbine might fail at some point, and then you have to replace it. Moving parts fail, man. I mean, as engineers, you know that. But there is a magic way to build something that measures the flow of a fluid through a pipe with no moving parts. And what you do is you take that pipe and you neck it down at a certain point. And remember from continuity, if I reduce the area, I increase the velocity of the flow. So I've got this fluid flowing through here. It's got a thick part of the pipe and a thin part of the pipe. And now, because the velocity in here is lower and the velocity in the neck down pipe is higher, and then I have Bernoulli, which relates pressures, V1 is lower and V2 is higher, that means the pressure 1 must be higher and the pressure 2 must be lower. There's a pressure difference between those two points as well. And I can take little tubes off, and I can measure liquid levels or their difference between them, and that difference is proportional to the velocity squared now, and I can actually measure the fluid velocity with a magic meter that has no moving parts. Quite often what you do is you do something exactly in the first slide of the class, or at the opening slide of the class. Usually what people do is actually connect those two tubes and have some sort of a fluid in here connected to that. And then what you can do is that little slug of material in this U-tube moves back and forth. It ends up being exactly flat and even if there's no fluid flow at all. But as soon as that fluid starts flowing, that you start getting a difference between the levels of one side versus the other. And then you can even put little markers on there and calibrate it. So that's called a Venturi meter, right? And this underlying principle of Bernoulli is not just applicable to measuring things in pipes. It's applicable to all aerodynamics as well. A lot of the time in air, you can actually kind of treat air, particularly air moving quickly and in a laminar way, in a way that where all the particles are moving together along specific lines, you can treat air as incompressible as well. And so Bernoulli is the reason why airplanes fly, why airfoils work. Because again, what you have is you have a simple airfoil here, and that simple airfoil, air comes around here, chunks of air come around, and now they're compressed into a little volume. The air is pushed together. It's like it's going through a smaller channel. And continuity says it has to move faster. It's kind of compressible too, but it does actually move faster. And since it moves faster, the faster flow, this term is larger, so the pressure has to be smaller. So compared to the bottom of the wing, the top of the wing has a lower pressure. Higher pressure underneath, lower pressure on top. The difference between those two pressures over the area of that wing is what produces lift. You could also think of it as the wing, yeah, imparting some net downward momentum from the top, from the air that flew over the top of the wing. There's some corresponding momentum of that air downward, which means there's got to be an equal and opposite reaction on the wing pushing upward. But at the end of the day, it's Bernoulli. It's differences in pressure. You can think of it as particles that are moving faster are moving more forward and less to the sides and have less opportunity to create pressure on that wing surface. While the particles that are moving more slowly are also of a larger distribution of transverse velocities, have more opportunity to bounce off the wing and create pressure as well. That's a microscopic way of explaining why Bernoulli works. But at the end of the day, I mean, this combination, this conservation of energy from Bernoulli is why sails work. It's why a sail doesn't catch the wind. A sail is like an airfoil in the wind. It's why Venturi meters work and all sorts of stuff like that. So, are there any questions about this? I just wanted to make sure I got to Bernoulli because when I was your age, I mean, when I was a junior as an undergraduate, I spent the summer actually working at NASA Langley on supercomputers doing computational fluid dynamics and doing visualization and programming of simulations of airfoils and air flow over airfoils and the turbulence that created. And it was great. It was a fabulous opportunity. So I've always had a sweet spot for Bernoulli and for hydrodynamics and aerodynamics based on that experience of working for an engineer for a summer. And that's why I like engineers. So let's take a break. If you want to leave and you don't want to do a review, that's fine. If you want to stick around and ask questions for a review, that's fine too. Let's restart at 10 after and I'll work through whatever problems you want. Yeah. I mean, I'll take photos of anything to work on. But if nobody asks any questions, there won't be any. Yeah.
Can you go over some questions by equilibrium, something like this kind?
Yeah, sure.
Something involved.
Yeah, I mean that this is sure. There's a let me see, so.
I start my homework last night, but I only did one question.
Well, yeah, there's a so let's see. Weight, tension, critical component. Okay. I'll work through that for you.
Hey. I just have a question about something.
Sure.
I have it in my notes or in my notebook with everything else.
That's
would you mind if I ripped it out
and
like, put it in a binder?
There's that. Well, you can keep it. So, are you? Do you think you're going to be going over your notebook over Thanksgiving break?
Yes, because it has
okay.
all my classes.
No, that, oh, that's fine.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Then absolutely. I mean, you can take photos and give us photos, or you can rip them out and give them to us that way.
Okay.
Just make sure your name is on it.
Perfect. You just want like the homework problems right now.
Yeah,
I'm guessing.
Yeah,
that's
exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's a representation that you work them out yourself and that you could go back and look at them and understand your explanation.
Just checking.
Yep.
Thank you.
It's the notebook that everybody's asking about. So when you work out the homework, you write it. You have some work that you write down. In the notebook? Turn in there. Yeah, when you do homework on the website, you write some of the homework down because you have to do work to figure out the homework. So you have notes from the homework? That's what we want you to turn in. Those notes.
All of them.
All of them, yeah.
I guess
it's in the syllabus. You have to turn in something. So turn in at the very least the last homework. So keep all the papers, turn it in. Because in the future you will want to go back and remember how you did a problem. If you throw the paper away, you don't remember it. Yeah, for the last, do it at the very least for the last homework. Okay. So.
That part C, the ice question.
Yeah.
To set up the same, so you have buoyancy, weight of block, weight of woman jumping, it's just that now instead of equal
to zero,
instead of equal
to
MA.
Yeah, exactly. You don't set all of that equal to MA, right? I mean, she's the one jumping. So she's exerting force down of a jump, and then there's also, you know, mg on her, and there's now the force of the jump for her is pointing in this direction. For the block, the force of the jump pushes down.
Right.
Right. And then there's also the, and this is the mass of the woman, this is the mass of the block. Right, and this is the buoyancy as well. So this force of the jump is what we calculate here. The force of the jump minus mass of the woman times g is equal to mass of the woman times
her. You know, high velocity is fine. You have to basically do it in two parts.
Yeah,
you have to force the jump here and then apply it.
Exactly.
This one is also
yeah, that can accelerate downward at the same rate.
Right.
It's different
right.
Mass.
But we can find it once we put all the pieces together, this, we can find the acceleration.
Yeah.
We need to find the
acceleration. No.
Because you're only
solving it just asks you, so do you own it? So when she jumps up, okay, there's what you're going to find out actually. That these two forces here are substantially larger than this buoyancy. So what's going to happen is that
it's
going to
submerge.
I didn't give you all the complicated stuff to figure out all the dynamics of exactly how it goes down. That was the point of that last part. And I won't ask you something kind of like that in the real exam.
You won't, or you? Or you
well, I mean, I'll ask you something similar to this, but I'll make it clear that I'm not asking you to figure out all the dynamics of exactly how this thing accelerates and whether or not it goes under the water and
right.
It goes down and comes back up again. That's the next section of the class. That's
okay.
Harmonic motion. Yeah, 2 meters per side, so square. And then
it's so it's 2 times 2 is 10.
Yeah.
So it'll be 4 cubic meters.
Yep.
Times the density of light.
Right, did I get something wrong?
I got it completely wrong. So.
Okay. No. You are absolutely right. I've used 0.6 here before.
Okay.
And it turned out that barely submerged the ICS problem. And I bet this number here is still the 0.6. I did the rest of it. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. My numbers probably need correct.
So I could use 0.6 for that.
Well, there's the here. Let's you know. Oh no. The what I'm saying is I made a mistake. You're probably fine.
Okay.
There's the if you take what is it 917 kilograms per 917 kilograms per meter cubed, and you're saying it's four meters cubed, right? Is the volume. Which should be 3668.
I think that's the
instead
number.
Of two, right, and that's the number. That's the correct number. So the what I had done is originally I had written this problem with a 0.6 thing,
okay.
But then I had to change that number because the volume that was submerged was not quite point. It ended up being point. Yeah, ended up being all of the ice. Or not, I mean, it ended up being a different number that wasn't round. So if I put in the 0.6 there instead, it's that 2,200 kilograms that's written there.
Okay.
So that number was written for a different number there. So I have to fix that. So thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you.
I made a mistake, and I will make a note on my slides to fix it. So I will say, you know, Ron, right, and I'll fix it.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for pointing it out. Okay. So somebody asked me to work out a statics problem. So here at least is a an example of a statics problem that comes from the book. So this is a statics example. And let's say we know the let's say we have a sign hanging from a bar connected to a building here, so this is a right angle. There's an angle theta here at least. And so let's say that we know the weight of the sign. We know the angle theta. And we know the mass of the bar. So I'm even making this a little bit more complicated than the example in the book. And what we want to do is we want to find out things like the tension in the line and the X and Y components of that force from the wall. So far, so good. So we have three unknowns. And remember, for statics problems, the basic equations, the fundamental equations that you're going to get are something like the net forces in the x direction is equal to zero, the net forces in the y direction are equal to zero, and the net torques are equal to zero. Yeah. Oh! Ah, thank you. Let's turn down the brightness. Can you see that better? Thank you. I'll have to wave my hand like that. There you go. Now it works. So let's draw a coordinate system. Can you see that? Not really. Let's draw the coordinate system in red. Can you see that? A little better. And so what we have is the net forces on the bar are equal to zero. Well, horizontally, what forces are acting on the bar? There's this force here. And let's say vertically it's there, FY. So in the horizontal direction, there's this tension here. There's an angle theta. So the tension x is equal to t times the cosine of theta, and the tension y is equal to t times the sine of theta. I'll get the sines right when I plug them in here in a little bit. So the horizontal force is acting on the bar. There's this x component, fx, pointing that way. The only other force pointing on the bar is this t sub x, which is t cosine theta. So f sub x is equal to t cosine theta. That's one of our equations. I did, right? Fx is pointing horizontally on the bar. So why would I include it? Because I know that if there was not a force from the wall on the bar, the tension of this line would pull the bar to the left. There has to be a horizontal component of the force from the wall, right? Because you're pulling the bar into the wall with that line. Yeah, it's a normal force. I mean, it's perpendicular to the wall, so you could write N there instead of F sub X, however you like, but it is in fact a normal force. That's correct. And then this would be a tangential force to the surface of the wall. This is static, so the net forces in the Y direction are equal to zero as well. what forces are there in the y direction. There's f sub y, which I drew as pointing up. There's t sub y, which is t times the sine of theta. There's plus t, thank you. And then there's minus the mass of the bar times g minus the weight of the thing. So all of those things together equal zero is the second equation. And now you see I've got two equations, but I've got three unknowns. T is unknown, and F, X, and Y are unknown. If this were, you know, if you didn't have the rotational statics, you couldn't solve this problem. So we need a third equation. We need the net torque is equal to zero. What was torque again? Remember, torque was defined as R cross F, or R times F, and the cross product is the sine of the angle. Sine of the angle between, you know, R and F. What? Sine of theta. R to F. So for the torque, let's rotate around the wall so that we can eliminate two variables, right? We don't have X or Y. Either one of these components supply no torque because they're acting through the pivot point. So the only other torque that we have to worry about, and let's say that we also have to know the length of this rod, of course. So the net torque, let's say that this direction is positive, so the net torque is force times distance, L, that's the torque for the sine, and the angle between them is 90 degrees, so this ends up being zero. The mass of the bar times g times the distance r, the radius is L over 2. And for the torque from the tension, right, I have this r pointing in that direction. The tension is pointing up here. Here's the theta that I know. So the angle that I should put in here is 180 degrees minus theta. Right, that's how I get from R to T, with the radius to the force when I'm calculating this torque. And it points in the negative direction, so it's minus the tension times the length times the sine of this angle down here, which is 180, minus theta. What's the sine of 180 minus theta? It's the sine of theta. But you don't need to complicate that, right? The physics is done here. You can calculate, you know, now you've got a third equation, and this third equation, in fact, only has one unknown. It has the tension. I know the weight, I know the length, I know the mass of the bar, I know the angle. So the tension ends up being what? I divide through by L everywhere, and I divide through by the sine of theta everywhere, and I end up getting the weight plus the mass of the bar times g over 2, all divided by the sine of theta. Ends up being the tension in that line. Yeah. What was that? Yeah, right. The mass of the bar times gravity divided by 2, right? This is a force. It's up here. Because to figure out the torque, I needed the force times the radius times the sine of the angle between them for this weight. This weight is acting at the center of gravity of the bar, which is 1/2 of the bar's length. So I've got m, the mass of the bar times gravity times the length of the bar divided by 2. Yeah. So why did I use 180 degrees minus theta? Torque is this cross product, R cross F. And that is the magnitude of the radius times the magnitude of the force times the sine of the angle between them measured going from the radius to the force. So the radius points outward, right? This is the radius. The force is pointing up there. So I drew this little diagram down here to figure out, okay, this the angle that I put in here is the angle that takes the radius to the force, which is 180 degrees minus theta. So that's why I put in a sine of 180 minus theta there. And then I knew that sine of 180 minus theta is the sine of theta. That's how I ended up with it down here. But don't think that this is automatic. Think that this sine of theta comes from the fact that sine of 180 minus theta is equal to the sine of theta. Got that? Okay. So now this is great, right? If theta is an extremely small number, let's say theta goes to zero, this tension has to go to infinity. I'm pulling against the bar and I'm not applying any torque. But I need torque to counteract the pull of the mass of the bar and the pull of the sine. So if this angle gets very, very large, right, up to 90 degrees or close to 90 degrees, that's how I can reduce the tension I need in that line. So if I've got an engineering problem of this cable has a certain strength, I can figure out what the minimum angle is that I need to make to support the sine with that cable. But at the very least, the tension in that line, sine is always less than 1, so the tension in that line is always going to be greater than the sum of the weight of the sine and the weight of the bar divided by 2. So far so good? Do my hand wavy thing? Next question. Point out the problem you want me to do. I take requests. I don't do Freebird. I do Stairway though. Which one? Homework question number 1?
Which homework set?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, it's part of your homework coming up, but I'll do it. Okay. Can I see that one, Ian? I'll transfer. Free play. I'm about to do one of your homework problems that you probably already did. So I've got a boom. And this thing is 60 degrees. And this thing is 5,000 newtons. So the weight of the boom is 2750 newtons. And the center of gravity is at 37% of the length. So it's somewhere in there. So this is otherwise very, very similar to the problem that we just did, right? So there is so that's the weight of the boom acting down here. There's this force down here from this weight. And there's what they want you to do is figure out the tension of this guy wire. And they also want you to figure out horizontal and vertical forces there. So what we're going to do is we're going to set up the same, you know, this is another statics problem. So of course, you know, the net x is equal to the net y forces is equal to the net torque is equal to zero. And there are three unknowns. The horizontal and vertical components of the forces at the base of this thing, and the tension in that guy wire at the top. So far, so good. So the net forces in the x direction is equal to zero. Well, what net forces are there? And these are forces now on the boom. The boom is this thing. So horizontally, what forces are there? Draw our axes, say x, say y, say this direction is positive rotationally. Horizontally, there's two forces, right? There's f sub x, and there's the tension in the guy wire up there. Everything else is vertical. So that means that the horizontal force is equal to the tension. One equation. The net forces in the y direction, they're equal to zero. On this boom, what forces are in the y direction? There's f sub y pointing up. There's the weight of the boom pointing down. And there's also this 5,000 newtons pointing down. So the force y is equal to the weight of the boom plus 5,000 newtons. Well, we know the weight of the boom up here, so this weight is really 7,750 newtons. That's f sub y. That's the second equation. And then the net torque, okay? 60 degrees, that means that this is 60 degrees, that means that this is 30 degrees. So what torques are there? We set the pivot point here so that there's no torque. The weight of that boom is pushing you clockwise. Let's say this is the, this is 0.37L. and the weight of the boom is acting down. So that's R. So this torque is equal to R cross F is equal to RF times the sine of the angle between those two. So in going from here down to there, I know this is 30 degrees. So this is the angle that I want to put in here, going from radius to the force. So I end up getting the radius is 37% of the total length of the boom, and the force is the weight of the boom, and the angle is now 180 degrees minus 30. For that part of the torque. So one part of this is 0.37L times the weight of the boom times the sine of 150 degrees. That's the torque from that weight. And now we have the torque from the extra weight here, which is, it acts at the length of the boom. It's 5,000 newtons. But this angular term is the same, because it's acting in the same direction as the weight of the boom, right? They're both pulling down. So again, this same picture holds, and so I use the same sine of 150 degrees. And then the tension, however, here's the tension of the guy wire, and here's that length. This is pointing in the negative direction, so it's acting at the length, the force is the tension. Now the angle between them is the sine of 120 degrees. Because that's the angle from the radius to the tension. And all of that stuff is equal to zero. The net torque has to equal zero. Physics is done, you get full credit, it's all set up. But the hard part here is getting those angles right, and the angles are always radius to the force. Draw a picture. If you draw a picture, you always get those angles right. Yeah? For the forces? Because the forces are just pointing in a specific direction, right? This fx is by definition pointing in the x direction. That's how I drew my axes, right? These are only horizontal components. The tension is pointing in the x direction. There's no angle component involved. And the same goes for f sub y and these forces pulling down. They're all pointing in exactly an x or y direction. There's no force acting on this thing for the force equations that's acting at a funny angle. I don't know if this guy wire was doing something like this instead. Yeah, I'd have to decompose the tension into x and y components to get components to put in here. But here, the tension is acting only in the horizontal direction. So the tension only appears in the horizontal net force equation and not the vertical net force equation, because the tension is only pointing in the horizontal direction. There's no extra angles involved. That tension, so let me explain it this way and maybe it'll help, right? The for F net X and F net Y, this boom think of it like a single object. I'm not worried about the tension or the torque, anything turning. There's a tension there. There's the mass of the boom times g, and there's also the weight of the object that's hanging there. And there's also f sub x pointing horizontally and f sub y pointing vertically. I don't worry about any extent of the object when I'm talking about f net x and f net y. Those I can just use this free body diagram of everything acting as forces on the object in those directions. I don't have to worry about any more angles. If the tension was pointing in some other direction, yes, like an inclined plane, I'd have to worry about angles. But for this picture here, I don't. All of the forces acting on this boom are forces in just x or y directions. I don't have to decompose any forces for these parts of the equations. Okay? Hey, look, it's time. Good luck. Study hard. Be well. I'll be available by email, except in the times that I won't be. May the force be with you. And the torque.